Okay, probably time. So, start today with some practical things that I forgot to do last time. All these courses, according to NTNU's quality system, should have three student representatives to work as, I don't know, a reference group for the course. I don't know how much work it is. It's probably not very much. They're just going to gather some or be independent of the teacher and gather some feedback about the course and how has been going and give some constructive feedback to the lecturer. So in order to do this, I need three names, and those people will then get contacted by the some administrative or student elective, I think, at in Trondheim, who will give you more information about the type of work that's you're going to do. So could you don't have to volunteer now, and I will remind you after the break. But could if anyone are interested in this, I would appreciate it very much if I could get two or three names to work as. What's it called in English? What do they call them? The student representative. Course representatives? I'm not sure. Okay, but you get the idea. You've probably been asked the same question from in other classes as well, right? So it's not a problem if you work for several classes for this. And it's nice if there are people from different study programs, I think. And even if there are somebody listening in from outside here, feel free to sign up for this, but I'll remind you after the break if there are no volunteers in the break. So what we'll do today is that we'll of course just continue with the same stuff we ended with last time. We started to touch in on the topic of hypothesis testing and the scientific experiment. I will talk a little bit more about biases in the beginning, but then we'll get to the more stuff on hypothesis testing afterwards. So we had a little talk about we talked about this when it came to reliability and validity in the last lecture. What do we mean by bias? I've used the word bias a lot. Bias means some sort of a skewness in the type of responses that you get. So we can define it more technical in the way I've done it here, that bias is any influence or condition or set of conditions that distort or affects the data in some way. And as we talked about last week, we always try to avoid biases by controlling for them. But more than anything, it's necessary to be aware that these things actually exist. That's the key issue here. Biases exist. We want to control for as much of it as possible, but at least we want to discuss it in some context. And of course, one of these biases has to do with the type of responses we get when we do different types of survey studies, where we get responses from a huge number of respondents. And there are different techniques we can use there as well. Let's say you have a thousand, you have asked for something that you want to generalize to a broad population. And even though you have invited a lot of people to give answers to your questions, well, you only get a few responses. And that is, of course, the normal thing. But still, you can do something with those data to check the quality of them in a better way. And one thing to do is to look at some typical independent variables that distinguishes the respondents from the non-respondents of your questionnaire. For instance, if you get a huge overweight of males at a certain age, which is different from the population that you want to say something about, well, then you have an issue that you may want to control for. You may want to check for this. You may want at least to discuss it in some ways. So check whether you are, of course, measure some of these independent variables. Not only because you're going to do statistics on them, but to check the quality of your sample, of your and these can be different things. Of course, age, gender are obvious things, but also, well, some other factors like in some contexts it can be hobbies, for instance. It can be the type of education you have, the type of job you have. It could be other factors as well. But the point is, try to identify if your sample looks like the sample you got actually looks like the population you have out there. Does the respondents differ from the non-respondents? One other strategy to apply could be to look at differences among the first responses you get and the very late responses that you get. In general, the idea here is that those who are very prone for this kind of self inclusion in studies, that's also the population that's most likely to respond fast. So you will have some kind of a if you look at the late respondents are more likely to be like the rest of the population. Those are the people that reluctantly comes into your study. And maybe they are more representative of the general population than the early responders. So to take some kind of a split off thing among your responses based on when they came in, how fast they came in, and how many reminders you had to send out. Well, maybe that also gives you an indication of some kind of a bias in your responses. If they're similar, well, okay, then it's fine. Then you may have very few problems with this self-selection. If the difference between the early responders and the late responders is huge, well, then you may have a problem here. So be aware of some of these things. And of course, what you also could do as a method of identifying these sample biases is to be more, or try to contact some randomly selected respondents as well, and try to get hold of them and see if they differ from the sample you actually got in your among your respondents. So these are all strategies that you can apply to make sure that you actually get a much better idea about potential biases among your respondents. And as we also touched a little bit, even though we try not to be biased, it's in the human nature actually to be quite biased when we try to interpret information. Our nature is to draw rather quick conclusions, as we, I guess, talked a little bit about in the first lecture as well. The human mind is, well, we're constructing reality. What we believe that we experience is a construct. It's not pure data. We create the world around us, how we understand it. So, and of course, in the beginning, we also have some. We have ideas. We do our research based on some ideas of what we will find. So that also makes us somewhat biased. We tend to find what we are looking for, more or less, based on the context. We choose what we want to study, and in some cases we also need to interpret the results. We need to understand them and put them into other categories. So this whole thing is very much a constructive process. We're not very good at this, and half the group here have seen these examples that I'm getting to now, but I think it makes a good point. Any data point, any impression that we get is tend to be based on how we read things and how we look at it and the expectations that we have in the beginning. If, for instance, you read this in a horizontal way, well, you probably see this section here as, this is now an I and an S, right? But if you take the bottom one, it's probably 1 and 3 or 5, I'm not sure. I was still thinking about this myself, probably a 5, isn't it? If you read something like this, if you look at this one from this direction compared to that direction, you see something completely different, right? You either see a hare, rabbit, I'm not sure, or a seagull, based on the direction you look at this. So we construct the world around us. Even for more, we can skip to this one, as I've shown others, which is from one of the sons or the spacecrafts that very early went to the planet Mars, where they tried to, they were looking for landing spots and took very detailed photographs of the surface of Mars to decide this was one of two Viking spacecrafts. And the first one was surveying the landscape very much in detail. And this specific picture created a lot of interests, and it tend to do the same now and then. And it's the basis for some conspiracy theorists still. Because if you take a close look up here, you'll probably see something there, right? What does it look like? could be some kind of a monkey face or a human face, right? Which is it feels natural to do something like this, and some have interpreted this as proof of life on Mars or something. They try to communicate with us. But of course it's just an artifact. We know it's an artifact. It's just a by chance thing. It required NASA to try to find the same spot again on a couple of occasions with other spacecraft. So they wanted to take pictures of the real face on Mars from other angles on different times of the day. And when they did that, that wasn't very good, was it? Let's see if it has something to do with this, maybe. So when they did that, I think this was the original picture, but you can actually found some newer pictures of the same thing. So this was the original from 76, and they've done it a couple of times later, and of course the whole thing disappears. It's just a mountain, so there are no communication in this. But we tend to be good at constructing these things. It's in our nature to do this, and this is of course also bias. This is what we mean by bias. We construct the world. We're not necessarily focused on doing that, and we're not cheating. It's just in our nature as processors of information to do this. I guess that was my message on this topic. You're not cheating even if you are biased, but you are cheating if you're not trying to control for your biases and not trying to discuss it in different ways. But of course, a very good anyway. No matter what you do, as I said, the main problem we have here tend to be low response rates. That's our main issue here. We want to get more respondents. And there are, of course, different ways to make sure that we get more respondents. There are times where people are more busy than other periods. Try to avoid them. Try to select periods. Don't do this over Christmas, or don't do it midsummer and expect a lot of respondents. Don't do it over Easter. Avoid these periods. If you're focusing on students, don't do it right before exam periods. Do it on periods where you know people can invest a little time in you. So do good choices there. Of course, the other two points here can be put together. Make good first impressions and try to motivate. As we have discussed, when it comes to self-selection, the main thing on self-selection is that you actually believe in that this the topic that you're going to give answers on is something that is relevant for you. That's the most likely factor that differentiate a responder from a non-responder, that you're actually interested in the topic. So make people interested. Present the story. That's also an argument for very good, you could say, introductions, which is also an ethical concern, that you should tell people what they're going to be involved in. But doing that also gives you a very good way to make sure that you get a good number of respondents. I should actually tell them that this matters for you. So, it's a good strategy. Motivate them, and of course, it's feel free to be persistent and nag people to give responses, but don't expect too much. There is the general rule is that the additional response that you get after having given two reminders, for instance by email, is extremely low. You won't get many more. So the first reminder is usually very effective. The second is somewhat effective. The third one, don't mind using it. It's not, you don't have to, and it gives you very little back. But give reminders. The first one is good. Okay, that was some kind of a sum up of the problem of self-selection and biases and very important things for the discussions that we always have on representativity and generalizability of results from studies we do. There's always a problem to know where to enter this discussion that I'm having now, but a lot of you are doing types of research that involves looking at how something develops over time. So, are older people different from younger people? Do we change over time? Some kind of an idea about are we different now from what we were earlier, for instance? But in order to do that in a good way, well, at the least thing you have to do is to measure things on different populations. Or you can follow one population. There are different strategies here. The ideal, of course, developmental study, if you want to see how something develops over time, is to follow the same group all the time. But it's an extremely resource and time-demanding process, at least if you're going to discuss something that develops over a long time. Let's say I want to say something about how intelligence levels, I'm taking an example from my field now, how does intelligence levels develop over time? Well, the ideal experimental procedure here would be a longitudinal approach where you follow the same people from, let's say, they were 7 years till they're 70 years, a lifespan. But of course, then the study would have to have funding for 70 years as well, or 63 years. And the researcher would probably have to live for all that period, which is are all definitive risks in a study. But you agree, this is the correct response, or correct way to approach this, because then you would see whether individuals differ in intelligence over a lifespan. Do old people get slower and dumber or something like that? But of course, very difficult. It has been done actually on this area that the example I give now on intelligence was actually done by a Norwegian researcher. Her name was Sul Same. She did her psychology studies back in the, I think it was in the 1930s or something. She lived till she was 94, and she did the last study on her segment of people, those who weren't dead, because most of them died before her. And she did that over a time span of some 70 years between the first and the last one. So that's one of the major longitudinal studies that have been done. But she took them every 10 years through their life. So she started with a pretty large group and ended up, of course, with a smaller group. But at least this gave her a lot of control. But this isn't practical. So what we tend to do is something else. We tend to do what we call a cross-sectional study. So at one point of time, more or less, we measure all 10-year-olds, all 20-year-olds, all 30-year-olds, all 40-year-olds, etc. So we measure something we want to see the development of at one point of time. But of course, an interesting thing here is that these types of studies may create some very strange artifacts. And one has to be quite aware of these things when results from this kind of cross-sectional studies are discussed. Because it is a difficult thing to do. The data here are fake. They're just I've just made two curves here. But the actual story behind it is true. So these results, not the actual numbers, but the story here could be real. You can find data that supports this. So let's say the question here is the average height in centimeters, which you can see on one of these axes, of Japanese males. And if you did, and on the other axis you have age groups, 20-year-olds, 30-year-olds, 40-year-olds, 50-year-olds. So do we shrink over time? Could be the question here. How does height develop over time? And of course, the true thing is what we would see in a longitudinal study. We would slowly become shorter. Slowly, slowly, because of gravity or something. Less muscles, or I don't know what. But this is reality. We shrink a little bit over time. But very slowly. The problem, if you did this on the Japanese population, it's not absolutely correct now, but if you did this, let's say, 10, 15 years ago, and you did a cross-sectional study, which is the red line here, you would get some very strange results. You would see that young people are very high. They're 175 compared to what the old guys actually were. And then you would have a slight fall before you have a very dramatic drop over a 20 years period here. And then they become very small again when they're old. Any ideas of what has happened? What's the problem with this cross-sectional study, do you think? They're both real data, or could be real data. They are constructs, but they could be real data. How can we explain these differences between a cross-sectional and a longitudinal study? A suggestion here? Yeah, but why do we become shorter so suddenly? Why do 50-year-olds suddenly shrink? Which this looks like. Suggestion there? Yeah, you have to go further back, because these people were born before World War I. Sometimes in the 50s, something changed dramatically. They started to get richer. They started to eat proteins from other sources than they usually had proteins. They had very few protein sources. Started eating meat instead of just rice, or adding a lot of proteins, which is extremely helpful when you grow. And that actually is one of the factors that will make you take your full potential. So that's what happens. There is something completely different. That's not part of your story that has happened here. So haven't measured how people are shrinking. You measured something else. You measured the effect of proteins in your meals. So these are, of course, in a much smaller scale. You will find these things in studies that tries to say something about development that are cross-sectional. When you do a cross-sectional study, you need to be extremely aware of this, because you try to isolate. There are so many things you can control for that has happened in history that you just ignore here. So be aware of it when you apply these types of methodologies. When you try to compare cross-sectional and longitudinal studies. We're getting to the more details on methods later. Now, what we do in, as we probably have mentioned before, what we want to control for, there are very few phenomena that we want to observe that actually, where we actually observe the true score of some phenomena. What we do is that we are taking height and trying to take control over the errors that are involved, either by trying to take them away from as much as possible from the equation by having very good experiments, or by applying different types of statistical methods to make it more or to make this control better. Let me see, I thought I had some demonstration that we could use here. This won't show on the... maybe it won't work here at all. Yeah, maybe we can do it after the break, and I can show you the example that we're after here. Back to this one. I'll just start this demonstration sometime in the break. Let me just remind you about some central terminology again, which you need to know, and that we will use a lot when we are doing hypothesis testing. And that is the word hypothesis, just a reminder. The hypothesis is then the best guess or the best prediction we can have of an outcome. And it must be made in a way that makes it possible for us either to falsify it or confirm it. So it must be something that we can say something about, either by numbers or by some other source, if we do qualitative things. But anyway, these are the basics of the scientific process. We need to formulate some kind of a hypothesis, and we need to say something about whether this hypothesis is true or not, whether they are true or not. And we have, again, two types of hypothesis. We have the scientific hypothesis, saying that in most cases, this is quite straightforward. It tells us, it predicts an effect. It says that something works. This independent variable will affect the outcome of an independent variable. Or on this independent variable will affect the outcome on a dependent variable. See, it's difficult to use these words correctly, independent and dependent variable. So the scientific, in most cases, you have to be quite creative not to have it like this, but in most cases, the scientific, the H1, the scientific hypothesis, predicts an effect of the independent variable. While the null hypothesis say that there are no effect of the independent variable on the dependent variable. And it's these two variables that we are dealing with in hypothesis testing. So via some statistical means, we apply a decision-making process where we try to determine how likely it is. Actually, this can be difficult to grasp, but what we're actually trying to discuss is whether we are dealing with one or two populations, or if the samples, the data we get, are different, just, or are part, are just samples from the same population. For instance, let's say we are, okay, of course, very constructed and not at all true example that has to do with that has to do with intelligence. Let's just use that as I've used it before. It's something that varies in a population. And let us now say that it's very difficult to apply examples that doesn't become very politically incorrect or difficult to use here. Be generous with me on this. I'm just picking an example here now. Gender differences. It's very popular, right? And what I'm saying now isn't true at all, or it may be true, I'm not sure. Let's say my hypothesis is that for when it comes to intelligence, I think that girls are more intelligent. I'm doing it, it's politically correct now, right? I'm saying that girls are more intelligent than boys are. So that's my research hypothesis here. But the problem is that, of course, when we gather now statistics, we gather a huge number of samples from thousands of people here. Half of them boys, half of them girls. And we plot them on a graph in some way. What we may find is that there is actually a slight difference here in means. Right? Girls actually in our study comes out with a score that's 2 points higher than boys do. So in pure numbers, the mean is higher. But what we have to determine is whether this is just happening by chance, or if it's likely that this is a true difference. Because it's not so that all girls score 102 on the IQ test and all boys score 100. There is a huge overlap. These two populations have huge overlaps. They're both normally distributed. They comes out in a bell-shaped curve, the normal distribution, which we're going back to because that's important in a lot of hypothesis testing. So the dumbest girls can just as well be dumber than the dumbest boy. And the most clever boy can be way higher in score than the highest scoring girl. That's just can happen by chance in your population. But in most cases, there is a huge overlap. So are we dealing with two populations, or are this just an artificial thing that's happened? Because when we measure things several times, we get different numbers. So the decision-making process here is to decide whether we are dealing with two populations or one, and if we are dealing with if we decide that we are dealing with two populations, well, then we reject the null hypothesis. And that's the decision-making process we do. If we decide it's one population, well, then we keep the null hypothesis. But there should be an overwhelming chance that the scientific hypothesis is correct before we reject the null hypothesis. And we express this in, for instance, in... in significance levels, which is a term we will meet now and then. Well, so in order to actually measure something or to do this hypothesis testing process, we need not only to say something about the mean values, we need to say something about how they vary, how are they distributed. How are the two groups that we are talking about in the scientific hypothesis, or as independent variables, how are they distributed? And if it's, the distribution is very wide with a huge overlap between two groups, well, it's very difficult to determine whether these actually are two different groups or one group, if you haven't got a huge number of respondents, of course, which is a way to compensate for this. But I'll show you this in when we actually do some hypothesis testing later. Yeah, I think this is a good place to take a break. So let's take 15 minutes and start again. Okay, time to start again. As I said, I had a small demonstration. I actually made it run because this is just a, some kind of a. This just exemplifies the example that I started with here. With the, let's say we're observing a phenomena like intelligence where there actually is a slight difference in the beginning. These balls are dropped from different positions. But due to a number of chance things that happens, it can be during life, it can be in genetics, it can be in many things, it can be during the measurements, you tend to get a normal distribution of the phenomena that you're observing. So that's reality. You observe something that varies. And what you are to determine in your study is whether these are actually two populations or if it's only one population. So in the beginning, this can be quite difficult to find out. As you can see from the curve here now we've dropped so many balls that it seems to be a quite clear thing, where there are more red balls on one side and more green balls on the other side. So we get the effect of the actual effect we have on the top there. But if we had a small sample, for instance, this would be much, much more difficult. And you can also see here, by chance here, one of the green balls is the second most extreme one to the right here. So any phenomena that we observe, even if there is a difference, well, the outcome, the sample, the data that we're actually looking at can be very fuzzy and not so clear. But of course, with a lot of observations as we have here, this can somehow be compensated for. So let me go back to this one. Just make sure that we share the slides here again. It's a lot of practical things to think of with all this. So that one. We're not supposed to share the screen. So how can we make sure that we're not sharing the screen anymore? As I said, it's bear over with my but we'll get there. So this is approximately where we're going to be. Because what we are often are talking about when we are talking about when should we keep the null hypothesis and reject the scientific hypothesis, or rather, when should we keep the scientific hypothesis, the H1, and reject the null hypothesis? Because that's the decision-making process that we do. We're checking whether we should reject or keep the null hypothesis, and if the observed, by statistical means, the observed difference is less likely than a certain level, that it's less likely than, for instance, 5% or 1%, that it occurs just by chance. Well, in that case, then we keep the then we reject the null hypothesis and keep then our research hypothesis. If the chance that we have that we are observing, if the chance to get the same result by chance is, let's say, higher than the threshold we set at 5%, we'll do this in practice later. But if it's higher than the threshold of 5%, well, then we keep the null hypothesis. That's the decision-making process that we are doing in research. In this process, and this is the argument for having this, because a conservative approach, that we rather keep a false null hypothesis than a false research hypothesis. Well, the reason for this is there are two errors that we can do here. There is what we call a type 1 error, that we falsely reject the null hypothesis. That we actually reject the null hypothesis based on an error. We believe that the treatment that we're setting in is, we say that it's correct, even though it's not correct. Then we have done a type 1 error. If we fail to reject the null hypothesis, then we do a type 2 error. And what we say is that, in general terms, it's much worse to do or to falsely attribute something to an effect than it is to be conservative and keep the null hypothesis. So there should be an overwhelming chance that the observed difference that we have in our experiment, the observed effect an independent variable has on a dependent variable, is true. Not just a likelihood that it is true, not 51-49 in percentage, like in the voting system or something. It should be overwhelming. For us to say that an effect is true, there should be more than 95 or 99% chance that it is true. So that is the approach we do in hypothesis testing. It's a very conservative approach, but the idea is that we should avoid our general confirmation bias when it comes to discovering things in the world, and be absolutely sure that the effects that we are observing are true and not due to some chance occurrence. So this is the scientific approach. So we assume that type errors are the worst and focus at control of to avoid type 1 errors. That's our responsibility as researchers. Now, let me just talk a little bit about the project that you're doing, because we are, in this course, we're going to do some... You're going to gather some data in groups. So by a day or two, you will find some groups that you can assign to in Blackboard. I want you to self-organize in groups of it's ideally 4 to 5 persons, not more. And these groups should then find a topic to gather data on. And these numbers that you gather, they should have different qualities. There should be different measurement levels, like the ratio, interval, and scale measures, or nominal ordinal and scale measures, so this should vary a bit in quality. There should be different variables. We should have some control variables and some clearly expressed independent variables and dependent variables. But the project that you should do can be By the way, when I remember it, for those who are listening from the outside, or for off-campus students, there will be a similar project where you're going to gather some data and hand them in, and we will do some statistical analysis together. And then you will write the short report on it as well. Because that's the project for off-campus students. But for those of you who are here, I want you to organize in groups. And as I said, the type of project that you decide to do can be anything. The important thing is that we have some data to analyze. It can be something that's relevant for your study programs, for instance. Some have done that. Some are doing... I've had a number of information security students who've set out honey traps, for instance, to attract hackers and to see where they come from. They have some hypothesis of who attacks when and what type of servers or what type of names on the server is more likely to get more attacks, for instance. You can do something like that, which is maybe very relevant for courses that you have, where you also have a lot of data and maybe interests. It can be some other project which is of relevance to your study now, but most choose to do something that's just fun to do, which is fine. Maybe where you use some equipment that we have or something, or take some phenomena that exists out there or that you're curious about. Had a group of students previous year who did a short thing on some kind of an expression, which can be fun. Is the grass always greener on the other side of the fence? So what they did was that they took some color spectrometer or something and actually measured it. They decided on a methodology to measure this and went through a decision-making process where they decided whether this saying was true or not. Some do questionnaires. I've had usability studies where you either present yourself as the writers of the code or the writers of the program or the site that you're going to test, or that you do this as an outsider and test it for someone else and see the responses that you get. So it can be many things. And it's up to you. So I'm talking about this now because it's time now to start to organize these groups and to begin the discussion within the groups of what type of project that you want to do. I'm open for almost any projects as long as it's doable within the time frame we have here. You should gather some data by. Well, I say here by end of October, I think I will be more, I will push you a little bit more. So maybe a week earlier than that. And then we will do some actual data analysis together with me. So you will meet me at least two times. First, the groups will meet for a discussion about topics. So we just decide what to do and express some kind of a problem that we want to investigate. We try to express some hypothesis and we try to suggest some methods. So I will have one or two meetings with the groups on that before you gather data. And then it's up to you to actually gather the data, and then we will meet again and we will actually do hypothesis testing on the data. So we'll use a statistical package called SPSS to do data analysis on the data that you gather. And then you will, in the end, make a presentation. We'll find a time approximately mid-November. When we do that presentation, so that's the finalization of this course. So all groups will present their research to the others in a scientific format. Yeah. There should be numbers in there, because we need to do quantitative analysis of this data. But some variables, like the independent variables, can be names. But we need to at least count names. We need to see if an independent variable, let's say like gender, like method one or compared to method two, whether that has effect on something. So numbers, at least the numbers in the end there should at least be ordinal, so you can rank them in some way. Maybe if we can make ratios or count things into groups or do something like that. So it could be done, but we can discuss that later. And for these concrete discussions, let's do that group wise when you manage to organize it. But do something that's a little fun to do as well. There's been a lot of projects on what side does a was a loaf with jam on land when it falls from the table, for instance. Which design of a paper aeroplanes fly longest, or are longest in the air, or something like that. There's been a number of these projects, but of course, if you have something that's relevant for your studies, and even if you have some data already that you can try to do something with together with some others in groups, that's fine for me. But it is, you're not going to do all this process yourself. It's going to be we're going to do it together. So it's not a course in statistics. It's more like a course in methods and hypothesis testing, and how we read statistics. For the off-campus students, we'll do this statistical analysis on data that are gathered as well. One more thing, which I was supposed to say in the beginning, I think we have gotten an exam date now. If I don't remember wrong, it was the 4th of December. Am I right? 4th of December, and it's kind of late, isn't it? Does it start at... I even think it starts at 3 o'clock or something. So it's in the afternoon at that day. Yes. But as I said, there will be... I will make groups in Blackboard, and you can self-assign to those groups, but we can do changes afterwards. Hopefully it will work. It worked quite nice with the self-assignment thing last year. So hopefully we'll manage to do this this year as well. So some of you will probably do survey type of studies, some will do different types of experiments. And experiments, which we're going to touch on now, comes in many flavors. And you can see very many fancy names on experiments. You find different lists, and you can find different ways of organizing this. This is one such list. I think this comes from your course book. Where different experimental designs can vary from very simple one-shot measurements of things to very complex designs, which takes account for all kinds of biases and effects and confounding variables that may affect the result. And of course the idea here is to take control. We want to make sure that it is our independent variable that actually can be made responsible for the effect that we see, and not something else. And in order to do that, we can apply different methods to control for these external factors. Of course, a very basic thing could be a one-group design, where you first measure something, then you do something, and then you measure it again. For some things, this may be all you need. If you have clear effects, if there is no smearing of effects from this observation to this observation, for instance, if there are no general effect of just doing something that people experience, well, then this may be enough. But usually in a controlled experiment, we want to see, or in order to actually see whether we have an effect of the stuff that we actually introduce in the situation, well, we add some kind of control mechanism. And a very typical way to do this is to, well, for both the experimental group, which we have here, and the control group, which we have underneath here, we have the same observations before and after, but it's only one of the groups that gets a change between the first observation and the second observation. And then we can attribute the effect, the differences between these two groups can then be attributed to the only change we did in the situation, which was introducing this one. And the traditional example, which we all know a little bit about, are then the typical medical experiment here, where we have a control group that gets medicine, we have an experimental group that gets the treatment or a medicine, a pill that works, and we have a control group that also gets a pill, so it's not just getting the pill we're measuring, but they get a pill without the stuff we think works in the pill. So we just give them something else. So it's not the expectation of what is going to happen when you get the pill that we're measuring, but it's actually the content of the pill. So that's the typical experiment. One placebo group, which is the control group, and then one experimental group. This can be done in different ways as well. For instance, in many cases, the expectations of those who measure something can have an effect. So that is why we do what we tend to call double-blind experiments, where not only does the participant in the experiment not know whether he gets medicine or a placebo pill, but also those who administer the medicine don't know it. So they can't unconsciously or consciously leak information about expected outcomes, for instance. So this is the classical way of controlling for whether what you are introducing in the situation is what affects the situation or not. But it can be, you can do different things. Because one of the problems, for instance, with this classical experiment is that you don't, for instance, you don't know if doing a measurement actually affects the second measurement itself. That's something you don't account for. You don't account for history. That actually some time there has been a huge gap of time between the two observations. Maybe the time of season is more important than the type of medicine that you have applied. So there is a number of these things that may affect the outcome. And this is just an example of one type of experimental designs that tries to control for this. It's something called the Salomon four-group design, where you not only have one experimental group and a control group, which is what you see here. The R here means this is a true experiment, meaning that you are randomizing who gets into the control group and the experimental group. That's not a requirement for a true experiment, that it should be random whether you are part of an experimental group or a control group. That's a key criteria for a true experiment and not a quasi-experiment, which we tend to call it. When we do this, well, the first part of this is, of course, doing the same thing. But what we do here is that instead of letting all four groups have the pre-observation, we let them just go either directly to the post thing or via some kind of a treatment condition. So then we have four conditions, and by doing things like that, we can also control for history, for instance, for a number of potential third variables that might have occurred. I'm not saying that you should apply a design like this, because it's not very common to do it. But it's just to give you an idea that different experimental designs and mainly the reason for having so many different experimental designs is that we want to control for different things. And some small phenomena, for instance, where differences are very small, well, then you also need very sophisticated control. You need good randomization, you need good group sizes, you need extreme control over third variables in order to say that an effect is true. So you need clean data. While on other phenomena where the differences are large, you don't need that type of sophistication in order to say that you have a difference, because it's much more obvious. So the type of phenomena that we are looking at dictates the level of sophistication that we need to apply when it comes to the experimental design that we're applying. In most cases, in most studies you do, you will probably apply quite simple methods, or simple but easy methods. You will probably have problems in doing the type of randomization, although you should try to do that. Tossing coin, for instance, whether a person should be in the experimental group or in the control group is usually a good strategy, and not take the first 10 in the experimental group and the next 10 in the control group. It's probably not such a good strategy, because there may be something that decides whether you are coming in early in the experiment or late in the experiment. So toss coins till you have good enough groups, and then you can do something else. So you can apply randomization. And randomization is usually a good way to say that groups are similar. We have other types of designs as well. What we have talked about now are the more traditional controlled experiments. There is a group of experiments also called time serial designs, where we, instead of measuring something before and after we do something, we establish a very long baseline. We measure things several times because we think that any phenomena tend to vary a bit. So we establish a baseline over several observations, then we do something, And then we measured things, the same thing several times again. So performance measures can be typical time series measures. How long time you spend on a task, for instance, if you have a huge number of data. Could be established via this type of baseline establishment. It can be done with control groups, but it can also be done without control groups in a pretty good way, because what we can do then is to measure changes in the level, changes in level or curve or something like that after we introduce the change in the independent variable. We can also introduce the independent variable at different times for different people, for instance, to control for time or history or something like that. So there are a number of ways to do this in a good way. A type of design that some of you will use. I've seen it in use when it comes to performance things, especially. How long do people spend on certain types of activities in a program? The login situation, for instance, over time, before and after you've done something, because it tends to vary quite a bit. And then you establish this baseline, and then you see what happens afterwards. Does it consistently change, for instance? So different problems and calls for different strategies. Factorial designs, I'm not going into this now, I think. So let me just skip these, which I have managed to copy. When we do analysis of the data that we got, let's say the data that we got underneath that nice ball dropping thing, because we got a lot of numbers there, and they had a mean value, they had a distribution, so we can actually see them, how they were spreading out. Oh. This has become a very nice normal distribution. They're peaking out here now. This is usually a very good start. I will try to do this live on some data just to show you what types of statistics we can do. But just looking at distributions, whether the two populations are different, is usually a very good start. That we make histograms, which is actually what we have here. We have two histograms of two distributions, and we can right away see that they seem to be different. The reds are different from the greens here, and we have a huge overlap. But both these populations are probably quite similar, which they, of course, in the beginning, this would be very difficult to see right away. But connections, this can be a good start. We also usually want to take a look at not only the mean value, because for a lot of calculations, yes, it's the mean value that we actually that we use. But for a number of things, it can be a lot of information in looking at other There are other ways to measure some central tendency here as well, like the median, because if the median is different from the mean, for instance, there is an indication that you may have some, there may be some errors in your data. But if that's not the case, well, then there are some strange things in your data. A typical example, I don't know if I mentioned this in this class, but a very good example of these types of distributions where the difference between a mean and a median is actually quite meaningful is to look at income levels. Because if you look at the income levels in a nation, you tend to see that the mean is somewhat higher than the median. The median is the value that have 50% of its observation on one side and 50% on the other side. On income levels, for instance, in different countries, this difference is can be small or large. In Norway, it's rather small. In some countries, it's huge. And it tells us that there are something in the underlying distribution here which is probably the problem. In incomes, for instance, this has to do with that there is always a few who earns a lot. So they will take the mean up, but they won't take the median up. So if there are a huge number of people who earns 20 million Norwegian crowns, or if there is 100 or something like that, they will take a big piece, a big chunk of the money, and create a difference, a large difference between the mean and the median. There are countries that have a lot higher difference than Norway. The United States, for instance, is a good example of a population where you find huge gaps between the median and the mean. So it tells you something about the population, and it can also tell you something about the quality of your data. It can tell you something about, for instance, whether you have outliers or extremes in your data that's not likely to be there or to be real. Maybe it's due to it may be that you are punching some of the data manually still. We still do that. But it can also be that someone have cheated and entered wrong numbers somewhere. We have allowed them to enter wrong numbers. 100 instead of 10 would affect the mean a lot here and there. So getting a good idea of these things can be a good idea. In some cases, it's also important in addition to this, to actually look at the modal value. The modal value is the most occurring value. And for some types of data, which of course may vary quite a lot, and which may be on a scale type, the number of children you have or something like that, you could say that the average Norwegian woman have 1.4 children or something. But who would like to be a 0.4 child? So you could also, it's probably more, it's a good measurement to say what's the most common thing here. Well, it's probably most common for any woman who has children to have two. And that would be the most occurring value for adults in Norway. So there are different ways of looking at things when it comes to descriptive statistics. And we would also like to see the distribution, of course. We would like to see how the normal distribution that we have are looking like. Do the distribution we have, is it flat with long tails, or is it a central distribution with a long, high, nice peak? Does it have a very strange binomial distribution where you tend to have two hills and a valley between? Some phenomena might be like that. Some phenomena has a very long tail, where node is on the bottom, but there is a long, long tail upwards. So some of these numbers are important when we are looking at the data and comparing populations. And different populations may also be different, and then they are maybe difficult to compare in many ways. I think we'll just, in the end here now, say something about this normal distribution, because I tend to say that any phenomena that we observe out there, whether it's height, intelligence, shoe sizes, the score of almost anything that where you can score things on a large range, well, it tends to come out as a bell-shaped curve. It's less and less likely that you will come out in the tails. It's more likely that you are in the center somewhere. And one way of describing the distributions like this is by describing them in describing this the distribution you have in standard deviations. Because if you look at this normal distribution we have here now, or the two normal distributions we have here now, of course they're not perfect, but they tend to be a huge number of observations in the middle. But we don't know the values that's involved here. We don't know what if this scale goes from 1 to 100 or what it looks like. What we know is that we have a bell-like and normal distribution, and that's what we're looking at. And that has certain numeric qualities attached to it. Because we know that within plus minus one standard deviation, we have 68.2% of the total scores. So if we have a perfect distribution, this is how it would look like. Within two standard plus minus two standard deviations, we are covering some 96% of the population, 95.8, I think. And if you go more than three standard deviations out, you're only including 0.1 of your population. But the actual numbers involved here, they can be different. So for instance, when it comes to a standardized test, like a standardized intelligence test, we have decided that one standard deviation equals 15 points. And that's the way we've standardized it. So if you have an IQ score from 85 to 115, you are within the big chunk of the population in the 68%. If you are scoring, for instance, above two standard deviations, like 130, you are among the 2.2% most intelligent in the population. So standard deviation tells you very much about the spread in according to the scores you have in your experiment, in your measurements. But we'll show this when we get to real data. So I think this concludes today's lecture. So hopefully I'm There is some be alert for what's happening next week, because there may be only a recorded lecture for you next week because of some meetings. But I'll know this before tomorrow, so I'll post a message.